compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. The number again, 888-914-9149. I look forward to talking to you. Let's go to Amelia now, listening in Phoenix. Hi, Amelia.
Hello.
How old are you?
11.
Right on. So what would you like to talk about?
So in social studies at my school, we are learning about Judaism right now. And I've noticed, and it has been told to me, that Judaism and Catholicism are very similar. And I've also noticed that many religions are similar to Christianity and Catholicism. So I'm wondering how we can tell which one is the true religion with the true God.
That is an excellent question. I'm so glad to hear that you're thinking about these things. So here is how I approach that topic, Amelia. First of all, let me ask you, are you Catholic yourself, or what is your background?
I have been baptized, had confirmation, and I've done all the most of the sacraments, but
yes.
I don't necessarily specifically believe in it.
Okay. How come you don't believe in it?
Well, one, that question, and the main reason is that.
Is because you're not sure if the Catholic Church is the right church or if it's the true church. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's reasonable. I mean, you can't really believe in something if you don't understand it, right? So it helps to be able to understand it more clearly if you're going to make a decision to believe it. I understand that. I understand where you're coming from. Okay. So let me give you a little background here. A few things. Number one is to remember that all the different religions, so you can consider Judaism, Buddhism, Islam, even Hinduism, and other world religions. And look at the founders of each of these religions. By founder, what I mean is, who is the person, and in these cases, they're all men. Who's the person who started this religion? So you have Moses with regard to Judaism. You have Muhammad with regard to Islam. You've got the Gautama Buddha with regard to Buddhism. And in the case of Hinduism, it's not quite as cut and dry. There are other figures, but they also have many, many, they believe in many different gods. But in Christianity, you see Jesus Christ as the founder of this religious movement. And what's interesting, Amelia, is that when you compare Jesus to all the other founders, one thing becomes very clear, and that is none of these other people, neither Moses nor Muhammad or the Buddha or any of these other ones, none of them ever claimed to be God. They claimed to be prophets or messengers, people who spoke for God. But in the case of Jesus Christ, you have Jesus claiming to be God. And we know this in a couple of ways. One way we know this is because in the Gospels, these are the eyewitness accounts that were written by the men who were with Jesus, and they saw what he said and they did, and they wrote down the things that they saw. And on more than one occasion, Jesus was in danger of being stoned to death by the Jews, because that was the punishment. Stoning someone to death was the punishment for blaspheming God or using God's name in vain. Even if you just used his name in vain, you could be killed for that under the Mosaic law. And there's one particular incident. This is in John's Gospel, where Jesus says to them, as they're picking up stones to stone him, he says, "For what good deed of mine do you seek to stone me?" And they said, "It's not for any good deed that you've done that we seek to stone you, but because you who are a man are making yourself out to be God." So they understood him. Now, they didn't agree with it. They didn't believe that it was true, but they recognized that Jesus claimed to be God. Now, there are other sources that corroborate this, and that would come from like some of the Jewish writers who were alive during the time of the apostles or shortly thereafter, as well as some of the pagan Roman writers. And neither the Jews nor the Romans had any, they didn't have any love for Christianity. They didn't like the Jesus story. They didn't believe it. And yet they wrote, when they wrote about the Christians, the followers of Jesus, they wrote that these people believed that Jesus was God, and they believed that Jesus rose from the dead. So the resurrection of Jesus, Amelia, has a really big role to play in all this. Because Jesus, according to these eyewitnesses, as well as those who were maybe not eyewitnesses, but they were writing about what the Christians believed, they said that Jesus said that he would rise from the dead, and countless people said that they saw him risen from the dead. Now, they would have seen Jesus. I mean, they would have known him because they had seen him before. And so if somebody who had, let's say, said, well, hey, I'm Jesus risen from the dead, they'd say, you're not Jesus. If it wasn't really him, they would know because they saw him. They talked to him before his death on the cross. And so the point I'm getting at here is that the resurrection also sets Jesus apart, because it is his way of proving, even after all of his miracles and raising people from the dead and controlling the weather, making the storm stop, for example, and reading people's secret thoughts and casting out demons and all the things that Jesus did. And there were countless tens or hundreds of thousands of people who witnessed these events. So they saw it with their own eyes. And then the biggest event of all is that he rose from the dead. And here's where it gets really interesting. Are you still with me, Amelia? Are you following what I'm telling you?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting. So we have these records of Jesus doing all these things. Then he rises from the dead. And now, after he's gone back to heaven, now you're left with the apostles and the other first Christians, the ones who knew Jesus personally. And you probably already know what happened in that case. They were hunted by the authorities. The Jewish leaders did not like them. The Roman leaders did not like them. The Jewish leaders persecuted them, and whenever they could, they would kill the apostles because the apostles were saying, Jesus rose from the dead. Jesus is God. The Romans, who also didn't like this, but for a different reason, and that is because the Romans thought that this new group, these Christians, that because they were ignoring all the other gods of the Roman religion, the pagan religion, Zeus and Apollo and all the others, and from the Greek gods and the Roman gods, the Romans, they began to teach that their emperor was a god, and the Christians wouldn't worship him. So they saw this as a kind of crime against the state, that they looked at Christians as criminals because they wouldn't go along with the pagan custom of worshiping the Roman Empire, or I'm sorry, the Roman Emperor. So my point here is that imagine if you were one of those first apostles or one of those first Christians, and imagine that you knew that this was all just a big hoax, that Jesus didn't really rise from the dead. And you knew that because you were in on it, and they said, well, we're just going to pretend that Jesus rose from the dead. We're just going to tell people that because we want to get power, or we want to get money, or we want to get influence. So what would happen? What would you do, Amelia, if you knew that this wasn't true, and then suddenly the government cracks down and says, all right, if you continue saying that Jesus rose from the dead, we're going to put you to death. Would you be willing to die for something that you knew wasn't true? Or would you say, okay, I give, it wasn't true, don't kill me? Which would you do if you knew that it wasn't true?
Well, if I knew it wasn't true, first, I would have disagreed with it in the first place. I would have never been lying about that, because that messes with people's life, what they do, that changes their beliefs, that changes many things.
That's true. But let's say that you did, just for the sake of discussion. So let's say somebody convinced you, hey, you're going to get a lot of money, or you're going to have power if you just tell people that Jesus rose from the dead. So just play along with me for a minute. Let's say that you had done it. I know you're a good person, that you wouldn't do it, but let's say you had done it. And then the government says, all right, if you don't stop saying that Jesus rose from the dead, we're going to kill you. So if you knew that it wasn't true and he didn't rise from the dead and the government says, stop it or we're going to kill you, what would you do?
I would have said, you know what? Yeah, it's fake. Sorry, don't kill me.
Right. That's what I would do. I think that's what anybody would do. So here's where it gets really interesting, because now you have all these apostles and their followers, the other disciples and people. So you got hundreds, you have thousands of people. Now, we have this from historical record, who not only were willing to die because they claimed that Jesus rose from the dead, but they did die. And often they died in very painful, terrible ways. The Romans really liked to kill people in very painful ways. So now we have the question, why would they do that? Because they didn't get political power. They were hunted like criminals. They didn't have female fans. They didn't have money or influence. They didn't live in nice houses. They were talking about Jesus, and they were teaching about his resurrection, that he is God and all these things. And all of these thousands of people were willing to die for something. Now, I personally, this is where I come in, my own personal belief. I look at that, Amelia, and I say, I can't explain that away if Jesus didn't really rise from the dead. I can't account for the fact that all these people would be willing to die for something that they knew was not true. So the only reasonable conclusion I can draw from that, since I wasn't there and I don't have, you know, firsthand information, the only reasonable thing that I can draw from that is that they were telling the truth and that they did see Jesus rise from the dead. That would explain it, because if it were true and Jesus really is God and he demonstrated that to them, including by rising from the dead, then their behavior makes sense. And so for me, this is part of how I came to the conviction that the true religion is that which Jesus Christ established, because unlike those other religious leaders who never claimed to be God, he claimed to be God, and he demonstrated that he is God by what he did, the miracles and all the other things, including the resurrection. So for me, that's the starting point. And then I look at, well, what did Jesus do? Well, Jesus established a church. He didn't just pass out Bibles. You know, he didn't say, okay, everybody read your Bible and say your prayers. He said he's establishing a church. He's building it on a rock. He says the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And he also said to the apostles that he wants everybody to be in this church. And he said this in Matthew's gospel in chapter 28, where he tells the apostles to go into the whole world and make disciples of all nations and baptize them and to teach them everything that Jesus had commanded. So the last part of my answer is this. If you look back in history, you will see the Catholic Church, by that name, called the Catholic Church, in every century going back to the very first century when Jesus and the apostles were alive. Now, you don't see the word Catholic in the Bible, for example. That is a term that was developed by, say, the end of the first century. But that became very quickly the name that the church called itself and that other people called it. But the point is, you can see this church with its sacraments, the Mass, you mentioned confirmation, baptism, the Pope, bishops, honoring Mary, all of the things that we believe in the Catholic Church. You will see those things as you go back in time, all the way back to the very beginning. So that would rule out those groups who claim to be the true church, because the further back you go in time, as you go toward Jesus, these groups all disappear. So there were no Protestants, for example, no Lutherans, no Calvinists, no Baptists. When you go back a little more than 500 years ago, none of those groups existed. There were no Jehovah's Witnesses. There were no Mormons. There were no Calvary Chapel people. None of those groups existed. But you will find the Catholic Church, historically, the evidence is there, as you go all the way back to the time of Christ. So I'll leave it at this. On the one hand, with regard to the other religions like Judaism, Islam, and Buddhism, and so on, and some of these religions are basically all of them are aside from Islam, are older than Christianity. They go back further than Christianity. But for the reasons I just mentioned, you can see that Jesus changes everything when we realize that he's God. And then the second area would be all those other groups that came after the time of the start of the church. We can see that none of those groups actually can be the true church. So by using this way of studying the facts, you can arrive at the conclusion that, in fact, Christianity is true, Jesus is God, and the Catholic Church is the church he established. Now, I realize I've just given you a whole lot of information, so I'll pause and let you talk for a minute. What do you think about all that?
One thing that is still confusing me is, how do we know that those people weren't just making a story or something? Because,
well,
people could have...
You mean like the apostles?
Okay. Apostles are the people who wrote that God is real, God is true. They could have been lying.
That's true. They could have been lying. That is true. They could have been lying. But here's a question you should ask. Liars lie to get something, don't they? If you're going to lie about something, you're lying to get something. You're lying to get out of a punishment. You're lying to avoid some kind of problem. You're lying to get something, like you want to get money or you want to steal something. So lying is always done for a reason. There's some purpose behind it. You know what I'm saying? Do you see that point?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then just ask yourself the question. Let's say they were lying. What did they get out of it? They didn't get anything out of it. There was no benefit to them to lie. All they got was to be hunted, to be, you know, if they were caught, they were whipped, tortured, and then killed. So to kind of bring it back to you yourself, let's say that it's like the question I asked you a little while ago. If you knew that what you were saying was a lie, and you knew that if you kept telling people this lie, that you eventually were going to go to jail and probably killed, why would you keep lying about it?
To get enough power and money to, like, if I do get caught, then I have enough money, power to, like, say, oh, you can't do that to me because I'm too powerful.
Right. Now, if that were true and you could do that, that would be a reason. But you'll notice that the apostles didn't get money. They didn't get power. They got the opposite. They got no money. They had no power. They didn't get anything for lying, other than they got killed in the end. So that's a really important question you're asking. And it really, I believe it points to the fact that they weren't lying. They were telling the truth because they didn't get anything. If they were lying, they were stupid. I mean, really, really stupid. And maybe you can find a really, really stupid person who would be that dumb that he would lie for no good reason and then get killed in the end. But is it reasonable to think that you could find thousands of people who would do that?
No.
I don't think so either. Something to think about, right?
Yep.
Well, have you found this conversation helpful?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad. Well, do keep thinking about these things. Do keep thinking about them. And as a young Catholic, I realize you probably have a million and one questions, and that's good. Don't be afraid to ask questions. God wants you to exercise your intellect and to discover the truth. And so asking questions is a good thing. And by the way, you can let your mom know. She's probably right there in the room with you. But let her know that I would be happy to talk to you anytime. So whenever she says it's okay for you to call in, I would love to talk to you again. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Great talking with you. All right. On that wonderful note, why don't we take a quick time out? We'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Say a little prayer for that young lady. I have a feeling she's destined for great things. God willing. I'll be right back.
Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a new free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Hey, let me ask you a question. In the midst of all the tension that we've got right now with China over Taiwan and other parts of the world, not to mention, gosh, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and just all the different enemies out there, tell me if you think this is a good idea. This is from Human Events. Hundreds of Navy SEALs are risking being blocked from deployment after failing to get vaccinated, according to a lawyer who's counseling them. The number of SEALs involved in the dispute with the Pentagon amounts to as many as a quarter or more of all active members, a loss that could impact military readiness. Some SEALs were given a deadline to get the vaccine and have sought a religious exemption. The lawyer in question, Davis Yount, says, my clients include several Navy SEALs who are a small part of a large group of SEALs and other military members who are being asked to choose between their faith and their ability to serve our nation. He says they have been told that if they seek a religious accommodation, they likely will no longer be able to serve our country as Navy SEALs and have been given an arbitrary deadline to comply with the vaccine mandate. My clients need time, and we're seeking at least a 90-day extension to the mandate compliance deadline that they have been given. Similarly, there are hundreds of Navy SEALs, another person who's quoted in the article says, hundreds of Navy SEALs who have not been vaccinated do not want to take the vaccine or who have had and recovered from COVID and have the benefit of natural immunity. A large number of SEALs that I'm speaking on behalf of are facing the very difficult decision that even with a legitimate religious exemption that is based upon their commitments to Christ and God's law, they will no longer be allowed to be Navy SEALs. They are essentially being asked to make a decision between their commitment and their career as Navy SEALs. So the question I have when I read this is, and this is not taking a position on a vaccine per se, but in the middle of all the craziness that we're dealing with Iran and China and I guess to some extent Russia and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and all these, is it really that smart of an idea to tell our most lethal people, these special operators, I'm sorry, after all those years of training and all of your finely honed skills and all of your super preparedness to go in and take care of things that virtually no one else is able to do, if you don't get this COVID shot, I'm sorry, you are now sidelined. Does that make any sense to you?
Come on, man.
Because that doesn't make... Yeah. That's my reaction to this. Come on, man. It just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. And do you think China is doing that with their special operators? Do you think the Taliban and, you know, whatever's going on in Iran, do you think that they're saying to their best fighters, their elite fighters, sorry, guys, you know, yeah, we want to take down the great Satan. We want to take down America. But unless you get, you know, the COVID shot, you're not going to be allowed to fight. It's ridiculous. And it's mind-boggling because it's almost as if it's intentionally being done to weaken our military strength. And who would want to do that? Makes you wonder, doesn't it? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. 888-914-9149. Maybe if you're a special operator, if you're Army Airborne, or if you're a Navy SEAL, or you have some foot in that world and you want to share your experience with me, please give me a call. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Dub in El Centro, California. Do I have the name correct? Is it Dub?
Yeah, you do.
Okay, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Hey, so I've called before, but it's been a while. So I have baby number 3 on the way. My wife is about 4 or 5 weeks pregnant. We still don't know yet because we haven't gone to the doctor yet, but she's had some tests and we've confirmed it for sure. But and she's having
congratulations
and all that.
Congratulations, you patriarch. That's awesome.
Well, My question is that I don't know if I should get a vasectomy or not due to after this baby is born, we're not going to be really financially established after this one because my wife is going to quit work in order to take care of the three children and homeschool or whatever. I'm not sure yet, but we'll cross that road when we get there. But it'll just be my income. And I know you have 11 children. I was just curious of, is it, you know, is it a sin to get a vasectomy done? And you know, how did you go about it? Because, that's the boat that I'm in right now. And I'm not sure if, I'm going to be financially stable enough to take care of a fourth child or fifth or who knows, by myself.
Right. Okay. So I want to make sure I have it right. You're asking for my advice, right?
Right.
Okay. Don't do it. Don't get a vasectomy. First of all, it's a serious sin to do that because what happens then is every time you and your wife are engaging in the marital act, it's foreclosed on the possibility of children. And God says that you should be open to his plan. In other words, he has a plan for your life. He has a plan for your marriage, the two of you. And his plan for you may be just the three children that you have with the baby on the way. His plan may be to bless you with more children than that. But he, being God, knows what's best for you. Now, he's not saying that you should not be prudent. You and your wife obviously have to be prudent, and you have to husband your resources and be careful in terms of health and all the things that go into being prudent and wise in the way you handle your married life. You're still called to do that. So I don't mean to suggest that you just throw caution to the wind. But God, being God, will bless you not just with children, but he will also bless you with the means to take care of those children. So if you're experiencing the fear of the unknown, that's not unreasonable. I mean, that's a normal human emotion, normal human reaction. But you have to rise above that fear by saying, Lord, I mean, there's no limit to what you can do. And my wife and I, we're going to trust you and trust your love and your providence for us and for the children that you may bless us with. And we're going to trust you to take care of us. Now, I don't look to myself, and I would tell anyone else, don't look to me as an example of, you know, true abandonment to divine providence. But at least in my own experience, I can say the same thing is true that was true for us. We were always a one-income family. Nancy stayed at home the whole time. Now, she would do things to help out, you know, with the family budget, like she would take in some babysitting kids for daycare and things. And that was helpful. I mean, there were times when that was really very helpful. But I was the one who was out making the money, working, and she was working very hard at home. And it worked. And here's the other thing, too. Your standard of living can change. It can go up. It can go down. It can get better. It can get worse. But the fact is, you're not going to starve. Your children are not going to starve. You'll always have a place to live. And we found, I just offer this to you for your consideration, but we found that in those years where we had no extra money, we were barely making ends meet, they were the happiest years of our lives. Not that we're not happy now. We're very happy now, but in a different kind of way, because it was very simple, Dub. It was a very simple life, and in many respects, it was very liberating for us because we didn't have to worry about, you know, upkeeping, you know, the upkeep on a nice standard of living. We had a very basic standard of living. We ate simple food, and we didn't have money for vacations, but we were happy, and we enjoyed it. And we look back on it with great gratitude. Honestly, we do. And I would much rather have those years of simplicity and frugality than to have the best big screen TV or a boat or wonderful vacations, as nice as those things may be. I would far rather have that wonderful time with the kids growing up that we had. So everyone's different. Everyone's marriage is different. But I think these major issues are going to be the same across the board for people in general, that if you trust in the Lord, he's going to take care of you. It's really that simple. Jesus, I trust in you. And then put your faith in the Lord, work hard, find coupons to take the kids out for food, you know, where, you know, kids eat free. We did all that. You know, be creative if it comes to that. But don't be surprised. In fact, I would say expect miracles to happen. Expect opportunities to open up where you least expect them, because God is in the business of doing that for people who love and trust him. I mean, I could go on and on, but I think you get the idea of what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
And you can do it.
I get it.
Yeah, you can do this. What line of work are you in?
I'm a union electrician for NECA. I work for IBW, Union International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
That's cool. A lot of work there. A lot of overtime work there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, the third child's okay, but it's just the thought of the fourth, you know, where am I going to go next? And, you know, maybe it's time for me to, like, try to step up my game a little more and maybe be a superintendent or something.
There you go. Yeah, ambition is a good thing. You know, you don't want ruthless ambition, but men should be ambitious, especially so that they can take care of their wives and kids. Let me come back to the vasectomy issue for 1 minute, if I may, because there's something else I want to share with you. Over the years, I've talked to, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say, I've talked to probably a couple hundred couples, let's say over the last 35 years, who have expressed great sorrow that early in their marriage, maybe around the time that you are right now, that either she had her tubes tied or the husband had a vasectomy. And what I'm saying is, later in life, when they no longer were able to have children, because they had latched onto some bad advice, maybe given to them by a priest or, you know, somebody else who said, yeah, it's fine, go ahead and have a vasectomy. And then when they realized later God's plan for marriage and how often God wants to bless couples with children, when they do something drastic like that, thankfully nowadays these things can be reversed, but why put yourself through this in the first place? Later in life, I've had husbands and wives too, but men. I mean, I'm talking about like a fireman and, you know, guys who are, you know, tough and burly and all that, and they break down crying because they just are so sad that they didn't know the truth about this issue sooner, because they would have loved to have had more children. And they look back and they say, I wish we could have had more children, but we were blind to this issue because we got bad advice from somebody. And I've seen them cry because they're sad, and now they can't have those children. So you have a head start here, and I would be so sad for you and your wife if 20, 30 years from now, you were one of those couples looking back and saying, I wish we hadn't done that. So don't do it. And just forge ahead. Be brave and trust in God, and it's going to be great.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time and your advice on this. It's definitely the topic I needed to hear.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, you can do this, you and your wife together. And as the book title says, it takes three to get married. So just remember, you're never just the two of you by yourselves. God's always there with you, and he's always there to help you, and he will help you. Okay.
All right, Patrick. Well, I appreciate it, and God bless you. Have a great day.
You got it. Thank you. Thank you. Just to dwell on this for a minute, everybody, you know, I can speak from experience, as I just said, just knowing people and meeting people who wish later on that they hadn't made that decision. But I've also seen the other side of the coin. I've seen the side of the coin where those couples who were tempted, excuse me, they were tempted to, you know, for the wife to get her tubes tied or go on the pill or get a vasectomy or something like that. And then they look back 5, 10, 15, 20 years later at the other children that God blessed them with, and they say in their joy, they say, I can't even imagine what it would be like if we didn't have these children. These children whom God blessed us with and who have brought such joy and richness to our lives. I mean, think of it with the kids you have right now. Just imagine your children, whoever you have is your children right now. And try to imagine what it would be like to not have that child in your life. And these couples who overcame that temptation to snip something or tie something off so as not to have the possibility of children, if that's what God wants for them, they look back on it with joy to think, oh, what a terrible thing it would have been if these children hadn't been born. And that's all I need to say. I think I've said enough on that. Something to think about for sure. We're going to take a break and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. The number again, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
There's a man going around taking names. And he decides who to free and who to blame.
This is interesting.
Everybody won't be treated.
Are we doing a Johnny Cash thing this week? Because we did some Johnny Cash yesterday.
I do like my Johnny Cash.
I can tell.
When the man comes around.
All right.
You're the man, Patrick.
All right, Johnny. Thank you. I need Johnny to take a seat.
On your arm.
I like Johnny Cash too, but I got stuff to do, Johnny. Thank you. I love this story. I want to share this with you. Now, this is a courtesy of 6abc.com. The story of how a Lincoln University college professor ended up holding a baby during class was life-changing for a 21-year-old student who was finally able to take notes. I've always wanted to go to an HBCU, so I decided what's better than the first. So I chose Lincoln, said Imani Lamar, who is now a senior at the Pennsylvania University. 2 years ago, she was taking a class with Dr. Akil Dix, D-I-X, in the health sciences department. She had just come back to school from taking a semester off after giving birth to her son prematurely. Lamar's son had to spend months in the NICU. It was really hard, she said. Every day going to the hospital, seeing him and not being able to help him, it was hard. Christopher Murphy, who Lamar had named for her father, had become her world and her schedule revolved around his. When she told Dix, this is the professor, she had to miss class because she couldn't find a babysitter, his answer was no. No, he told me no. And I was just looking at him like, no, I can't miss class. I don't have anybody to watch my baby, she said. I'm not going to have one of my students miss my class because they have no one to watch their child. That's just not an option for me, said Professor Dix. Instead, he said, bring your son to school. That's just my character. I don't mind helping my students whenever they need me, Professor Dix said. Lamar had reservations about bringing her baby to class. How would he react? Would he be a distraction, a distraction to the other students? Would she be able to focus? But when Professor Dix started lecturing, something changed for Lamar. She realized she could do this. I never thought that it would come to that. And to have somebody who's there for me who really cares, it meant a lot. Lamar is now a few months from graduating, and she has two of her favorite guys, her mentor, and now her healthy two-year-old son to thank for that. She says, you really don't understand how much this meant to me. Now, what she's referring to is when she went to class, the professor held the baby during the class, you know, wearing one of those little baby, like a papoose carry thing. The professor, as he's writing on the chalkboard or, you know, doing all the teaching, so she's the young mom, she's in the class taking the notes, she's able to focus finally, she's not juggling the baby on one hip while she's trying to do everything else, and the university professor held the baby. Isn't that a cool story, Jim? You liked that when you first saw that, didn't you?
This is when the news wins. This is the kind of news we need more of.
Oh, yeah. I think, and the picture is pretty awesome, too. You know, you see the professor, he's teaching the class, he's holding a little baby. And mom can get her studying done because she's now not encumbered by the baby. She can focus on the class. So it's win-win. And win-win-win, because win for the baby, win for the mom, and win for the audience of the Patrick Madrid Show. May I say to you, I like those stories as well. I want to share one other one that we're going to go to the phones. 888-914-9149. I saw this on Twitter. Check this out. This is from a faithful servant. He says, a woman I've never seen in our parish walked into adoration last night with a beautiful baby. I was the only one there. She sat and was instantly emotional in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I normally don't speak to anyone in adoration, but I was moved to speak to her. She told me her baby was just diagnosed with cancer and she was petrified. I asked her if she wanted me to pray with her. She said yes. We prayed for an hour and left together. I found out she was not Catholic. I asked her how she ended up in adoration, and you know what she said? She said she Googled, where can I find Jesus, and it directed her to an adoration chapel at our parish. She asked me, was that really Jesus in there? And I looked her in the eye and I said, without a doubt. I don't know why God places me in these situations, but he does. I gave her my wife's cell number and asked her to call this lady to see how she could help. My wife is meeting with her today over coffee. Please pray for my wife as she helps this single mom and a sick baby for mom and child. She Googled, where can I find Jesus? Thank you, Google, for doing something good for a change. Thank you. Talk about not restricting people. Google for the win. Where can I find Jesus, she typed in, and it directed her to the local parish adoration chapel. I have a feeling that lady is going to be Catholic in the not-too-distant future. I love that stuff, absolutely love that stuff. So, yes, please pray for that man's wife that she will be able to help and serve this woman in whatever way she needs. Let's go to Kate now in Idaho. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Patrick. I just thought You're maybe welcome. I'd give some encouragement to the gentleman that called about whether or not to have a vasectomy. And yeah. My husband and I were we decided to have children within 2 years of, you know, our first baby was born just before our second anniversary. We were both in college and we said, we don't want to wait. We want to have children when we're, as I put it, young, dumb, and poor. And that kids weren't expensive. And we went to college. Yeah, we went to college with our baby. And it was a really neat experience to be able to go to university. And, you know, my husband would take the stroller into classes with him. And he was getting his master's and I was getting my second degree. And so then I, you know, we had one, two. The second one was a surprise. And I was pretty shocked. Like, wait a minute. I thought we were in control of this. We were doing natural family planning. And had a little hiccup. So that was like the first thing of, oh, guess who's in charge? Not me. And number two, we were scared to death. And it was the most beautiful thing. The two girls were so close, you know, in age, 17 and a half months. But it all worked out. And I was so scared. And then, you know, my husband got a job, not a high paying job, but one that he loved you know, the area of what natural resources. Anyway, number three finally came along and we were super excited. We wanted six kids. And then, you know, there's the pinch, you know, and my husband was very uncertain about having number four. And, you know, we had people kind of looking at us like, what, you're having more kids? And other people, and I remember kind of an evangelical friend said, well, we're having a full quiver. And I didn't know what that was. But she said, just know we're praying for you as you decide, you know, how many to have in your family. And I was so encouraged by that. And my husband said, no, four is too many. We don't make enough money. And we were on WIC and, you know, we didn't take food stamps, but we qualified. And life was hard and we were pinching pennies. And I stayed home, you know, and kept saying, I have 2 degrees. I should be working. But no, I made the decision to stay home and homeschool the kids. And it was so wonderful. And when I said to my husband, Tom, I feel like, or sorry, his name, I said, I feel like we're given this crown by God and that there's a space for a jewel for each child. And if we don't fill that spot because we were so like, what, money is the reason that we wouldn't fill that with a jewel that God gives us, that we would be held accountable and that we would really, really regret it. And I swear within, you know, weeks I was pregnant and I was crying because pregnancy was really hard on me. I have autoimmune disorders. And he said to me, isn't it the best thing to be sad about? So we're kind of going back and forth, helping each other. And he said, God gives you 9 months to get ready for it. And And so the fourth one was born, and she was born on a Sunday. And Monday, he came home from work and said, "You're not going to believe this. I got two raises. One was a 5-year increase. The next was a merit raise. 13% increased." And it was like God was saying,
"That's big.
There you go." Yeah.
That is beautiful.
And, you know, then it was. And so I was in Walmart yesterday, and I saw this lady with a little doggy in her cart, and it was so cute. Then the next woman I saw, I opened up, and there's this baby in there. And I said, "That is gold. That is magnificent." Yeah. Doggies are cute, but a baby, I said, you have a lifetime of joy ahead of you and heart. And so don't be ever, ever afraid to have more babies, because now mine are all gone and, you know, grown up. And just a big family is the greatest inheritance you'll ever give this planet. So, and your family. So, and I'm just always inspired by you, Patrick. So thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Your story is beautiful, and I dare say it's encouraging for people maybe who are in the early years of their marriage and maybe are going through the jitters about, you know, finances and things like that. So you've given them gold just now by giving them the encouragement that comes from your own experience. You know, it's kind of like, I look at it this way, Kate, it's kind of like when you're on your deathbed and it's just about time to go into eternity, you're not going to be saying, "Oh, I wish I had watched more TV," or, "Oh, I wish I had seen more movies in my life." No, I mean, those things are, you know, "I wish I'd gone on more vacations." No one thinks that. But to be surrounded by family, your children, your grandchildren, And to know that, as you said, the heritage that God has blessed you with, that you're now leaving behind when the day comes. I mean, talk about comforting and consoling. I just love your story. Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. God bless.
You got it. God bless you, too. Now, for those who heard her mention quiver, you're saying quiver? I mean, is that like you're shivering? No, this is like the quiver of arrows. And she was alluding to, or the person who told her this was alluding to, Psalm 127. And in verse 3 it says, "Lo, sons are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the sons of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate." Now, I think that is such a picturesque way of describing the heritage of children. You know, they really are like arrows in your quiver. I mean, if you had to go into battle, would you like to have one arrow in your quiver or no arrows in your quiver, or would you like to have a full quiver? And I mean, there are a lot of different ways you can talk about this, but that picturesque biblical description of arrows in the quiver is a beautiful thing. And just for what it's worth, because that reminds me of the front cover of a book that was written by a Protestant guy back in the, what would it have been, the 80s. It's called The Bible and Birth Control by Charles Provan, P-R-O-V-A-N. I remember when I first read this book back in the late 80s, the thing that impressed me about it was that he, as a Protestant, was speaking to his Protestant friends, most of all of whom were totally fine with contraception. It was, you know, just assumed that you would have one or two kids, maybe three, and then you'd go on the pill or you'd do something else to prevent other children from coming in. And so he wrote this book as a Protestant. He wasn't Catholic, and I don't know if he's alive anymore, but the book is called The Bible and Birth Control. And what the book was his way of showing biblically, including the passage I just read to you from Psalms, that contraception is wrong. And contraception, of course, can be done in a variety of forms. It can be a barrier, it can be a chemical, it can be an action that one engages in during the marital act that could prevent children from being born, or would prevent children from being born. And I think all the married people understand what I'm saying. It can be a surgery, like a tubal ligation or a vasectomy. But whatever form it takes, whether it's a pharmaceutical or a barrier or something like that, whatever form contraception takes, it's a serious sin. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise. It's a serious sin. The church has always taught this, and the church continues to teach it, even though you don't hear about it very much. Pope Paul VI, he wrote an encyclical about this called Humanae Vitae. Now, he wasn't writing like an encyclical about you know, the evil of contraception, but he was writing the encyclical about the beauty of God's gift of life in the form of children. And as a natural part of that discussion, he had to look at the evil of contraception, which is a way of basically saying no to God. You know, it's saying, God, we know better than you do. And so Charles Provan, who was no Catholic, he was writing for his evangelical Protestant audience to saying, look, here's what the Bible says about this. All the way from Genesis 38 and the story of Onan. You can look it up for yourself and see what happened there. There's a good example of how God is displeased with contraception. And he also brought to bear a few other things that I found interesting when I read this book, and that was how adamant the major church, the leaders of the rebellion against the Catholic Church, Martin Luther and John Calvin and others, they too were adamantly opposed to contraception. Something to consider if you are not a Catholic, maybe you're a Protestant. Just realize that Martin Luther condemned contraception every bit as heartily as the Catholic Church does. I'll be right back with Hour 3. Please stay right there. I'm coming right back.